Thank you. A reading from the Wisdom of Solomon. Wisdom is a breath of the power of God and a pure emanation of the glory of the Almighty. Therefore, nothing defiled gains entrance into her, for she is a reflection of eternal light, a spotless mirror of the working of God, and an image of God's goodness. Although she is but one, she can do all things, and while remaining in herself, she renews all things. In every generation, she passes into holy souls and makes them friends of God and prophets. For God loves nothing so much as the person who lives with wisdom. She is more beautiful than the sun and excels every constellation of the stars. Compared with the light, she is found to be superior, for it is succeeded by the night, but against wisdom, evil does not prevail. A reading from the Gospel according to Matthew. The risen Jesus said to his disciples, "Go therefore and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit, and teaching them to obey everything that I have commanded you. And remember, I am with you always, to the end of the age." Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm glad to be with you. I'm grateful for this invitation. I have to admit when, Ashley first invited me, honored and delighted by the invitation to preach here today. And then I went to the church calendar and looked up the readings for today and saw that it's Trinity Sunday, which is usually when preachers are expected to convince intelligent people that 3 equals 1, which is kind of a dubious proposition and one I wasn't looking forward to. I started to wonder just for a moment if I'd done something to offend you. But the total awesomeness, or partial awesomeness, whatever you said, apparently were a good term, so that's not it. I want to take a slightly different tack than the mathematical to talking about the Trinity today. In 1993, some of you may remember this, some of you might have been participants. There was a conference in the Twin Cities. The World Council of Churches held an international conference on reimagining God. And this was the biggest. Some of you remember this. The focus of the conference part around reimagining God was the recovery of Sophia, which is the Greek name for wisdom, the biblical figure of wisdom as a feminine manifestation of the divine. And there were prayers to wisdom, there were hymns to wisdom, there were reflections on wisdom's role in creating a complex and amazing universe, and on the sanctity of women's lives and wisdom's role in inspiring women especially to dwell in the divine. And as you might expect, there was a ferocious backlash. There were male preachers getting up in the pulpits and letters to the editors saying this was heretical, this was blasphemous, this was idolatry. This was goddess worship. It was an infidelity. I mention that, the conference and the controversy that it sparked, because it's Trinity Sunday. And I want to make the connection there. We may not be very familiar with the biblical story of wisdom or the figure of wisdom, but there was a time when she was a member of the Trinity. And that's not the way we talk anymore. Now, sorry if parts of this sort of sound like a lecture in historical theology. I'm used to talking that way. I'll try to contain the academic vibrations somewhat. But in a way, that's my point. Mark Twain famously quipped that people who love sausage and respect laws should never watch either of them being made. To those two things, I would add Christian doctrine. If you are attached to Christian doctrine, it's better to avoid looking at how it actually comes about. The paper trail can be very unappetizing. So I want to trace, just briefly, the history of wisdom. Wisdom is The Hebrew word is chokmah, the Greek is sophia, so the name Sophia comes from wisdom in the ancient world. Wisdom is the largely unsung hero of the biblical story. We all know Yahweh Tsabaoth, the Lord of hosts. He is the warrior God who, by a miracle in combat, brings the people of Israel out of Egypt, delivers them to the promised land, defeats their enemies in fantastic battle after battle. He demands obedience and loyalty. There is Yahweh Melech, the God who is king in Zion, who rules the nations in justice from his capital in Jerusalem and through his Messiah, and monarchy is what he is all about. He rules and obedience is what he seeks. And then there's Chokmah, there's wisdom. She is an elusive, powerful, winsome, feminine presence that we get glimpses of in various parts of the Bible. She doesn't demand obedience or loyalty so much as she seeks understanding among people and understanding between people and the divine. In a lot of Bibles, you can't even see her. There are translators who, when they get to wisdom, lowercase the word because they know it's just an abstraction. There's nothing to see here. Move along. But wisdom is unmistakably a divine person and unmistakably feminine. In the book of Proverbs, the book rails against seductive women who will lead men astray into doing stupid things as if they need the help. But then wisdom raises up her voice, and it is a flirtatious, enticing voice, as alluring as any seductive woman. She cries out in the marketplace, "Come out of the streets, you men. Come into my house. I have prepared a feast, wonderful food and wine. Get to know me. Let's spend time together. You'll be glad you did." It's flirtatious language. She is portrayed specifically as an alluring feminine manifestation of the divine. She's almost swallowed up completely in the wisdom literature. King Solomon gets all the credit for being the wise king, even though the Bible is very clear he is a tyrant. He does stupid things. He's an arrogant. He's a tyrant. The Torah says, in warning, before there was ever a king, the Torah says, watch out for tyrants. A tyrant will multiply wives, will abuse your sons and daughters, will amass wealth for himself, will destroy your nation. And that's what Solomon does. It's like a job description of Solomon himself. He destroys the nation. The kingdom is divided. But he still gets the credit for all the wisdom literature. No scholar thinks that's true, but he gets the credit. We don't hear from wisdom again until later, after the biblical books that we call the Bible are completed. Writings from our Apocrypha, like the Wisdom of Solomon, what I read earlier, and the Wisdom of Ben Sira, and some other writings. Wisdom, Chokmah, has become even more splendid, even more radiant. She is still divine. She is still present with God at the very beginning of creation. God delights in her intelligence and her wit and her playfulness. This prayer we began with, I think, says it very nicely, to call her a kind, laughing agent of mirth, gentle embodiment of mercy. That's a wonderful description here of spirit, but biblically of wisdom. And it is her playfulness, her intelligence, her cunning that crafts the universe and makes it the complex and awesome and delightful place where we live. In Ben Sira, is this where I am? I've lost my place already. No, this is where I'm going to be. She is the source of creation. She makes all things, not only the world around us, but also human intelligence, wisdom. The wisdom we have, our reason, is the gift of Chokmah herself. She is the source of the light that enlightens everyone who comes into the world, to use language which may be familiar to us. In the Wisdom of Ben Sira, we get a specific story about her. She is sent out from heaven like the dove from Noah's Ark. Interestingly, we have the image of the dove here, which we usually think is a symbol of the spirit, but before this was attached to the spirit, the dove was an image of wisdom. Sent out like Noah's dove from the ark to look for a place to land on the earth. Wisdom goes forth and finds that place in Israel. She settles in this one nation among all the nations of the earth. She inspires them, she enlightens them, she guides them, she delivers them. And in the Wisdom of Solomon, from which I read, the long history of Israel is retold as if it is wisdom rather than Yahweh that leads them. Wisdom is there at every stage of Israel's life. She delivers them from slavery. She guides them through the wilderness. She speaks through their prophets. That story takes a slightly darker turn when we go a little later to the book of 1 Enoch. That may not be on your bedside table, but it was one of the most popular books among the Dead Sea Scrolls. It was probably a book Jesus and his disciples were familiar with. Jesus uses language that's in 1 Enoch, not in the Bible. Chokmah seeks, wisdom seeks a sheltering place on the earth, according to 1 Enoch, and can't find one. There's nothing but parched ground, which is to say, all of humanity rejects wisdom. Even in Israel, no one receives her. She comes to her own people, she is not received. She goes back into heaven, but she waits patiently. And according to that story, in the future, a son of man will be sent among human beings and will teach wisdom, and those who embrace the teaching of that son of man will be made the children of wisdom, the children of God. I'm trying to strike the echoes that should really sound in our ears. This is familiar language because it plays into our New Testaments. The clearest retelling of the story of wisdom is right there at the beginning of the Gospel of John, and this should sound very, very familiar. There is wisdom. She is in the beginning with God. She is intimately present with God. She is herself divine. Through her, all things were made. She enlightens everyone who comes into the world. She came to her own people and was rejected. They refused to know her. But those individuals who did receive her became children of God. The difference, of course, is that the Gospel of John changes the feminine noun Sophia into the masculine noun Logos. Wisdom has become the word. Scholars will debate until the end of time just why that happens, but what I want to notice is it's effectively a gender change. Wisdom has become now a masculine noun. And after that change, we really don't see the church looking back. The church doesn't try to recover Sophia after that point. In the gospel I read, this is the gospel for today, for Trinity Sunday, it's there apparently because Jesus, talking to his disciples after the resurrection, speaks about baptizing in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. That's the language we all recognize. That's the Trinity. But it's strange to hear Jesus talking that way because nowhere in the Gospels does he ever walk around saying, I'm one of three persons of a heavenly Trinity. He doesn't seem to know the doctrine. The Gospel was written by people who did know that doctrine and they put it on Jesus' lips, but it doesn't really fit there. It doesn't sound right. In fact, we don't find anyone talking about a Trinity of God until about 100 years after Jesus' death. A figure named Theophilus of Antioch, you may have his books on your bedside table, but in translation, I presume, I don't know. Theophilus writes, we Christians believe in a triad, the three figures, God the Creator, Word, and Wisdom. Christus, Logos, Sophia. Those, he says, are the three persons of the Trinity we Christians confess. That's the first time we have anyone talking about a Trinity. And notice the language, the Creator, Word, and Wisdom. That's not being strange. That's a really reasonable thing for a Christian in the second century to do. Because Christians are arguing all the time with Jews. Jews are saying, there's one God in heaven. Everyone knows that. It's in the Bible. Christians say, oh, look again at the Bible. And they look at all the passages that talk about divine wisdom. There she is at the beginning, right in God's presence before anything is made. And the Christians say, see, there's another person in heaven right there, and it's wisdom. And they began to say, that's how we know Christ is a heavenly being. But they held on to wisdom, the wisdom passages, to know that. It isn't until the last part of the second century, a man named Irenaeus of Lyon, the man who writes a huge body of literature called Against the Heretics, He's got a grudge. He wants to set everybody right. He knows orthodoxy and no one else does. And along the way, he says, we all know those wisdom texts. They're very, very important. Whenever you read wisdom, say spirit. He does not just a word change, but he affects, again, a gender change. In Greek, all nouns have some kind of a gender to them, but some nouns have gender because they're personal nouns. Wisdom has become spirit in Greek, which is a neuter noun, but when Irenaeus is translating into Latin, spiritus is a masculine noun. And if you have learned, if you accept his reasoning, that every reference to wisdom becomes a reference to spirit, then all language, especially in the Latin Church, becomes masculine language. There are no feminine presences left in the Trinity. That, what I call a sort of theological campaign of mansplaining, reaches its final, I don't know what else to call it. It seems to me that's an apt description of this. It reaches its final form in the Nicene Creed, where even in Greek, even talking about the spirit, which is technically a neuter noun, masculine pronouns are used. The spirit, he has spoken through the prophets. That's very deliberate. That's a gender change in Greek in the 4th century. And from that time on, wisdom is effectively erased. Wisdom is effectively withdrawn from the Trinity, and the Church doesn't look back until the 20th century, until moments like the conference in Minneapolis, until artists like the artist who has painted this portrait on the front of our bulletins. It is entitled Sophia. I notice that Sophia has the burning heart, which is a Catholic representation of the Virgin Mary and of Jesus Christ. So here, Sophia, wisdom, is being assimilated to Mary. If you're Roman Catholic, that's not surprising. When I used to teach at St. Catherine's, I'd go into the chapel there, Roman Catholic chapel, and the first thing you notice is a big statue next to the altar of the Virgin Mary, seated on a chair. Not just a chair, it's a throne, and the inscription is Sedes Sapientiae, the seat of wisdom. Here, wisdom, all of the magical and dramatic things said about wisdom are embodied in Catholic tradition from the Virgin Mary, so that feminine aspect survives, although it's sort of contained apart from God. There is this, what I'm calling mansplaining, there's this sort of withdrawal and suppression of the feminine in the Christian tradition. I see from nods and eye movement, it sounds like none of this is terribly surprising to us. We're used to this sort of being the story. I think it's important to notice that those feminine aspects of the divine are not finally suppressible. They can't be completely eliminated. They're in the language of spirit as well. Spirit, which isn't obviously a feminine metaphor in Greek or Latin or English or any other language other than Hebrew, it's still true that in the letter to the Romans, the Apostle Paul talks about creation using the very feminine metaphor of a woman in labor. It's hard to mistake that as anything but a feminine metaphor. This is creation convulsed with the effort to bring new life and a new reality into being. And Paul says, the Spirit causes us to groan along with that labor. We, in effect, are made, through the Spirit, co-participants. We're made partners in that labor. We are feminized. We are made mothers who are giving birth. It's a dramatic metaphor. No one else in the New Testament talks that way. No one else uses spirit language in that way. But Paul is so convinced of the power of that feminine metaphor, which has a long history to it itself, that that's the way he speaks of spirit. This is a long sort of rambling history, and I'm sorry for the rambling part of it. But the real sermon, I think, is what we might be able to say to one another about what it is like to walk in wisdom and what that life of the Spirit means for us today. In light of Paul's metaphor, in light of that metaphor of childbirth and a world in convulsion and struggling for something new to be born, Just a few weeks ago, I was in the Capitol Rotunda with several hundred people, and there were a variety of people. There were clergy, I met Ashley there. There were public school teachers, there were janitors, there were various union people and organizers and members. There were home care providers, there were immigrants and immigrant advocates. There were LGBT and Black Lives Matter activists and Native Americans and members of Muslims and Jewish and Christian congregations. All these people brought together by their various organizations to join in a single protest. They were protesting, this is probably very familiar to everybody, the bills that were presented to the governor. There were budget bills that late at night, the night before this protest, some Republican legislators had packed into these budget bills little policy provisions that they knew wouldn't pass on their own. And they were considered dangerous to the people who had gathered for this protest. They would have done injury to immigrants. They would have stymied teachers and other workers in trying to negotiate labor rights. They would have deprived those communities of say regarding things like wages and environmental concerns. They were in very various ways, if not inimical, at least things we should have debates about in public. But they were sort of packed into bills late at night. That alarmed me. I was really kind of impressed. I'm surrounded by hundreds of people I haven't met. A lot of them don't look anything like me. And we're all on the same page. We're all singing the same song. We're all chanting the same chants. We're breathing the same kind of protest. I got it. I realized, well, this doesn't just happen. The organizers have done a real good job of getting people informed and passionate about issues they care about. That takes a lot of effort. That takes struggle. The kind of struggle that I think Paul might have in mind when he talks about the struggle of labor, the effort of childbirth. I was also moved just to be part of a mass like that, of people who were all breathing and blending their voices into one voice, into one protest. I think that that kind of effort, that kind of movement to bring about change and to try to protect the human community and the environment, that kind of movement is part of the work of wisdom in our world. It is, I think, part of what the Apostle Paul was talking about. It's in our efforts for a better world that breathing together, that breathing in the breath of God, that our participation in the life of the divine takes place and the renewal of creation becomes possible. That's one example. Obviously, there are myriad expressions that we could discuss, and I really do believe that the kind of discernment we need is something we must do together. It's not for you just to take my word for it. But I do invite that discernment individually and with others around you, and to explore what does the way of wisdom mean for us today. My prayer is that we may walk more and more in the ways of wisdom, and that wisdom again will lift up her voice through us.